for this February the 16th. This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your Tuesday headlines. The White House today announcing the extension of a federal program that helps qualified families with assistance from mortgage and rent payments. We'll have details just ahead. Also, the Biden administration once again ramping up the number of COVID-19 vaccine doses being sent to states each week. During a call with governors, the president's coronavirus coordinator notifying states that the weekly vaccine supply will increase to 13.5 million doses. That's up from 11 million doses that is currently being shipped. Americans flew a lot less last year because of coronavirus. The Transportation Department reporting a 60% drop, making the lowest demand for air travel since 1984. By the numbers, 368 million passengers boarding a plane last year. By comparison, more than 922 million boarding in 2019. The story shaping Washington today, ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. And we begin at the White House, where the president announcing a program extension to help families behind in their rent or mortgage payments. This is a joint effort between the Departments of Housing and Urban Development, Veterans Affairs, and the Department of Agriculture, keeping the foreclosure moratorium in place through the end of June. It was set to expire at the end of next month. Press Secretary Jen Psaki announcing details and explains just how many Americans will be affected.
There's also news out this morning about a foreclosure moratorium extension. Some of you may have seen the COVID crisis has triggered a housing affordability crisis with more than 10 million homeowners behind on mortgage payments and communities of color at even greater risk of eviction and foreclosure. Today, the administration is taking another step to bring urgent action, relief to the American families struggling to keep a roof over their heads. This is something the president talked about on day one. We talked about on day one, but today the Departments of Housing and Urban Development, Veterans Affairs, and Agriculture announced they will extend and expand the foreclosure relief programs, building on the steps President Biden spoke about a couple of weeks ago. These critical protections were due to expire in March, but as part of today's announcement, the foreclosure moratorium and the mortgage forbearance enrollment window will be extended through June 30th. The administration will also provide up to 6 months of additional mortgage payments to forbearance for borrowers who entered forbearance on or before June 30th, 2020. These actions will bring needed relief to most of the 2.7 million homeowners currently in forbearance and extend forbearance options for nearly 11 million homeowners with government-backed mortgages across the country. It's critical, it remains critical, that Congress pass the American Rescue Plan to deliver more aid to struggling homeowners.
And that American Rescue Plan that Jen Psaki, White House Press Secretary, talked about would also implement another $10 billion, a fund to help qualified homebuyers catch up not only on their mortgage payments, but other bills, including utilities. Vice President Kamala Harris is claiming in a new interview that the Biden administration was, quote, starting from scratch to develop a national vaccine distribution plan. That interview aired over the weekend as part of the Axios.com HBO program. The vice president indicating that the Trump administration left little behind to begin a mass inoculation program. She said, quote, there was no national strategy or plan for vaccinations. We were leaving it to the states and local leaders to try to figure it out. During an interview earlier today, infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci on CNN responding.
On the issue of whether there was a plan in place before the Biden administration took over, Kamala Harris, she spoke, the vice president, of course, spoke to HBO Axios over the weekend, and she said, she used this phrase again, we're starting from scratch. And I wonder if you agree with that, that the vaccination plan come January 20th of this year, that you were starting from the beginning there, or there was something in place that just needed improvements.
What I think the vice president is referring to is that the actual plan of getting the vaccine doses into people's arms was really rather vague. I mean, it was not a well-coordinated plan. Getting the vaccines made, getting them shipped through Operation Warp Speed was okay. But I believe what the vice president is referring to is what is the process of actually getting these doses into people. That's something that we had to get much better organized now with getting the community vaccine centers, getting the pharmacies involved, getting mobile units involved. So that's what I believe she was referring to.
Okay. Do we have a plan now, in your view, a workable plan to get a significant enough plan to get vaccinations into people's arms?
Yes, absolutely, Jim. The critical issue is that the demand far outweighs the supply. That's the issue. As these vaccines start coming in greater quantities, as we get into March and as we get into April, with both Moderna and Pfizer increasing the amounts of doses they'll give us, in addition to J&J, I'm a little disappointed that the number of doses that we're going to get early on from J&J are relatively small, but as we get further into the spring, there'll be more and more. That's what we need, Jim. We need more doses. We have a good plan how to get those doses into people's arms. We just need more vaccine.
That's from Dr. Anthony Fauci. And a new number is from Johns Hopkins University, with the U.S. leading the world in COVID-19 cases, now at nearly 28 million coast to coast, and the death toll in the United States, just over 487,000. New York, Texas, Florida, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Illinois leading the list of COVID-19 deaths. And New York Governor Andrew Cuomo is at the center of an escalating controversy over deaths in nursing homes in that state, how they were counted, and how they handled the request for the data. The Democratic governor was praised early in the outbreak for his news conferences. He also published a book back in October titled American Crisis: Leadership Lessons from the COVID-19 Pandemic. But now he is facing calls for an investigation and possible limits on his executive authority. It's coming at a political price. New polls out today showing his support across New York is slipping. We will talk to a Wall Street Journal reporter in Albany to give us the backstory on this controversy. Yesterday, Governor Cuomo explaining what his administration released and what it withheld.
I accept responsibility for that. I am in charge. I take responsibility. We should have provided more information faster. We were too focused on doing the job and addressing the crisis of the moment, and we did not do a good enough job in providing information. I take total responsibility for that. The pain in it is it created confusion and cynicism and pain for the families of the loved ones. I've always consulted with the legislature. I consult with other politicians. I have no problem consulting with the legislature. Anyone who wants to stand up and raise their hand and say, here's my position, great. But these are public health decisions. They're not local political decisions.
That from Governor Andrew Cuomo yesterday, and joining us on the phone is Jimmy Vielkind. He is covering the story in Albany for The Wall Street Journal. And clearly this story has been unfolding over the last couple of days based in part on the comments by one of Governor Cuomo's top aides. So take a step back and explain what this is all about.
Well, this really started in the spring when the virus raged through New York State. It was one of the first major epicenters. And thousands of New Yorkers, including thousands of residents of long-term care facilities, quickly succumbed. In April, there were as many as 800 people a day dying around New York State. So after the rates ticked down over the summer, people started searching for answers. And a big question emerged as to a state order that required nursing home operators to not refuse patients based on their coronavirus positivity strategy. There was lots of speculation, and there were lots of statements from nursing home operators that this order may have contributed to the spread of the virus in their facilities, which studies have shown and experiences all around the world have shown are really rampant feeding grounds for the coronavirus and have been a source of lots of fatalities, lots of sickness, and lots of illness. So Governor Cuomo has been very careful throughout the pandemic to try and provide steady leadership for New York, and he gained national renown for his daily briefings, which were televised on cable news, and which provided a pretty sharp contrast to what people at home were seeing coming from the American White House. The fact that the numbers from nursing homes in terms of the number of people who died may have been kept artificially low and may have been underattributed by state officials, has really led to lots of questions about Governor Cuomo's performance, whether or not it was more of a halo than an actual substantive action. And what we're seeing now is lawmakers angry at what they see as a reluctance to share data and let there be a full airing of the facts so that if mistakes were made at some point in the early stages of the pandemic, they can be studied and they can be corrected going forward.
And so based on what you're saying, we may never know the full count of how many New Yorkers died as a result of coronavirus, especially elderly New Yorkers.
Well, the state's death toll for long-term care facilities, which is nursing homes, adult care facilities, and assisted living facilities, is now slightly over 15,000. Initially, that number was closer to 9,000. And the real difference had to do with where a resident died. The state, from the early days of the pandemic, was only recording long-term care facility deaths for people who died at their facilities. So if you lived in a nursing home and you passed away from the coronavirus at the facility, it was attributed as a nursing home death. But what we knew anecdotally was that hundreds, if not thousands, of people were getting sick in nursing homes, being taken to a hospital, and then succumbing to the coronavirus in that facility. We now know that that represented more than 4,000 people across those various types of facilities, which has increased the death toll by almost 50%. So this disparity now seems to be well known. And to your point, it may not be fully known, Steve, because record keeping for these things is spotty. Testing wasn't available earlier on in the pandemic. And there are some patients who are presumed to have died from coronavirus, but were not confirmed to have died from coronavirus. What we do know is that the scope of the virus's spread and its fatality among long-term care facility residents is higher than what the state had previously reported. That has led to outcry among lawmakers. And in addition to fueling that policy debate, it's also had political implications for Governor Cuomo that are right now playing out in the state legislature in Albany.
And of course, as you point out, we're seeing that in his poll numbers dropping 10 points in the latest survey since last month. Let me remind our listeners, we are talking with Jimmy Vielkind. He is a reporter based in Albany for The Wall Street Journal. So will there be an independent investigation in the state capitol?
That remains to be seen at this point. Republicans have been pushing for the creation of some sort of outside commission, and that legislation has been around since the summer. It hasn't really advanced or gained much traction from the Democrats who control both the state assembly and the Senate. Republican members of Congress in New York have also pushed on the federal Department of Justice to expand a probe into what happened in New York's nursing homes. We haven't heard anything from the Justice Department about that in any fashion. It's also, of course, not it's obvious to listeners that there's been a change in administration in the federal government. And while the Trump administration publicly posted the letter it sent to New York and the governors of three other democratically controlled states this summer, under the administration of President Joe Biden, we haven't heard anything about these investigations. So far, the independent inquiry that has borne the most fruit was conducted by Attorney General Letitia James, another Democrat here in New York, who initially put forward the estimate about the number of nursing home deaths, which finally prompted, after months of delay, the state health department to disclose the fuller figures that I just recounted. The investigation is ongoing. It seems, based on statements from Ms. James and from the report, that it's right now focusing on individual nursing home operators. But an open investigation can go in many directions, and it's unclear whether or not it will look more deeply at state policy decisions that could have led to problems in nursing homes that we've seen play out.
More details in today's Wall Street Journal and available tonight at WSJ.com. Jimmy Vielkind in Albany, we thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
And there's news today from the Pentagon, which will be deploying more troops to vaccination centers in what will be the first wave of the increased military support with the White House in a campaign to get more Americans inoculated against COVID-19. FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is coordinating with the Defense Department. Acting Director Robert Fenton briefing reporters earlier today.
Do you still expect that you will use and need the full 100 military teams? And how quickly do you think you will be able to get those out to various parts of the country? And for the general, I don't know if either you or Ms. Fenton, if you could explain a little bit to us about the difference between the 100 teams, 100 vaccination centers that the Biden administration has said they want to set up, and how that number jives with the 100 military teams or the other teams that the general has talked about. Thank you.
Yeah, this is Bob Fenton, Acting Administrator of FEMA. Hopefully you can hear me better now.
Yes, a little better. Thank you.
Okay. So how did we get to the 100 teams? What we did is we looked at, as vaccine comes more available and we get to a point in March and April, another vaccine comes on, we need to make sure we have the throughput in the system to vaccinate people. And so we looked at 100 teams as having the capability to vaccinate over 400,000 people per day. For example, right now in the United States, we're up to vaccinating 1.67 million people today, 1.67 million people a day. So as vaccine increases and supply increases in out months, we need to have other ability to vaccinate people. How do we do that? One, we're providing funding, the $3.2 billion I talked about, to state and local governments to bring on their capability and resources. Two, the president's authorized the National Guard 100% to bring on more resources from the National Guard. Three, we're augmenting states and local governments with gaps of personnel from the federal side, whether it be vaccinators, equipment, supplies, maybe locations to assist them in vaccinating. But we always knew along the way we would have to provide predominantly federally supported sites, which today is a pilot of these federally sites. These will continue to grow as supply comes on board. In addition to what we're doing through the states and the different sites they're using, whether it be medical facilities, those kind of things, we're directly vaccinating the skilled nursing facilities and healthcare clinical homes. And then we are also sending vaccine to the pharmaceutical pharmacies and sent 1 million doses last week, 2 million doses next week. And so we want to use all above to vaccinate Americans. How much will we have to get to those 100 teams? It depends on how much the pharmacies can do, how much states and local governments can handle, and what is the gap. We want to make sure we have the capability to go up to almost 500,000 vaccines a day. That's what the 100 teams buys us. How much we'll use will depend on vaccine supply and the capability of state and local government, the pharmacies, and other avenues.
That update on how U.S. troops will be used to begin a mass vaccination program nationwide, Robert Fenton is the acting FEMA director. And winter continues with a vengeance in many parts of the country. Texas remains the hardest hit, that state bracing for a second winter blast after a record-breaking storm leaving as many as 4 million homes still without power tonight. This latest storm will begin with a mix of sleet and snow tomorrow morning in Texas and Oklahoma, and then make its way up to Pennsylvania, New York, and New England by Friday. You're listening to Washington Today. For this Tuesday, you're listening to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your political headlines. Former Senator David Perdue of Georgia confirming that he is seriously considering running for the Senate again next year after losing his seat in last month's runoff. Former Senator Perdue, defeated in his bid for a second term by now Democratic Senator John Ossoff, is considering challenging Senator Raphael Warnock next year. Senator Warnock won a special election to serve the remainder of former Senator Johnny Isaacson's term and will have to run for a full term of his own in 2022. Nevada Democrats saying goodbye to their caucus system, the state party moving to end the use of caucuses in the 2024 nominating contest, part of a concerted effort to push the state to the front of the primary calendar. The bill introduced in the Nevada State Assembly would convert the nominating system in the state to a primary election. And a scathing new statement by former President Donald Trump taking direct aim at the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell. We'll have more of that just ahead. In other news, the chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee today filing a federal lawsuit accusing former President Trump, as well as attorney and former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, and two extremist groups with illegally conspiring to intimidate and block Congress's certification of the 2020 election. Mississippi Congressman Benny Thompson is alleging that former President Trump and Rudy Giuliani's false claims on the election essentially fomented a raid that violated the Ku Klux Klan Act. As a way of history, that act passed by Congress in 1871, the law put in place after the Civil War to bar violent interference in Congress's constitutional duties. The lawsuit alleging that Trump, Giuliani, and militia members, including the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, sought to harass and impede lawmakers on January 6th. In a statement with a response, Trump spokesperson Jason Miller saying, quote, President Trump has been acquitted in the Democrats' latest impeachment witch hunt. President Trump did not plan, produce, or organize the January 6th rally on the Ellipse, and President Trump did not incite or conspire to incite any violence on the Capitol on January 6th. Instead, the former president says the blame should be pointed to the mayor of Washington, D.C., Muriel Bowser, and Speaker Pelosi for rejecting additional requests for security on Capitol Hill. Well, Speaker Pelosi is calling for Congress to get to the truth of what happened on January 6th with the insurrection. In a letter released earlier this week to her colleagues, she said the House will move quickly to establish a 9/11 commission-style investigation of the mob attack, as well as the security failures that allowed that mob to overrun the U.S. Capitol. On her new podcast titled You and Me Both, former Secretary of State and 2016 presidential candidate Hillary Clinton asking the House Speaker about the next step in this investigation.
As you have said numerous times, has other agendas. What they all are, I don't think we yet know. I hope historically we will find out who he's beholden to, who pulls his strings. I would love to see his phone records to see whether he was talking to Putin the day that the insurgents invaded our Capitol. But we now know that not just him, but his enablers, his accomplices, his cult members have the same disregard for democracy. Do you think we need a 9/11 type commission to investigate and report everything that they can pull together and explain what happened?
I do. Let me, again, to your point of who is he beholden to, as I've said over and over, as I said to him in that picture with my blue suit,
right,
as I was leaving, what I was saying to him as I was pointing rudely at him, with you, Mr. President, all roads lead to Putin. I don't know what Putin has on him politically, financially, or personally, but what happened last week was a gift to Putin because Putin
That's right.
wants to undermine democracy in our country and throughout the world. And these people, unbeknownst to them maybe, are Putin puppets. They were doing Putin's business when they did that, at the incitement of an insurrection by the President of the United States. So yes, we should have a 9/11 commission, and there's strong support in the Congress to do that.
That was Speaker Pelosi and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Democratic candidate in 2016, at the White House today. Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked about this commission.
On another topic, would the president sign legislation to create a commission to investigate the January 6th attack?
Well, I saw an announcement, I believe it was yesterday, if I'm remembering correctly, by Speaker Pelosi, or some comments, I should say. It's, of course, Congress's decision to form this commission, as we've talked about a bit in here, but it's certainly one the president would support. And President Biden has made clear his views on the tragic events of January 6th, including where responsibility for them lies. He backs efforts to shed additional light on the facts to ensure something like that never happens again. In addition to the recently announced desire to put together a commission or form a commission, we'll continue to work with Congress to identify measures that the federal government can take going forward to prevent violence we saw on January 6th. And as you know, probably, Mary, there's a number of hearings that are upcoming in the coming weeks, and we'll be cooperative with those, of course.
What would you hope to learn through a commission? Because obviously we saw a very thorough airing of the events last week.
Again, I don't think the tenets of the commission have been formed. That's up to Congress to do. We have a role to play in the federal government, of course, with ongoing investigations out of the Department of Justice. But he supports efforts to move forward with it, the desire to have one, certainly understanding and knowing how much the events on the 6th impacted members sitting on the Hill.
That from today's White House briefing. Again, an update on the insurrection that took place on January 6th. There will be three congressional hearings next week looking into Capitol Hill security. And as you heard Speaker Pelosi, her call for an independent investigation, there does appear to be bipartisan support for that. Late this afternoon, we talked to Washington Times Justice Department reporter Jeff Murdock.
Yes, there has been bipartisan support for this, even before House Speaker Pelosi sent her letter yesterday. Even as early as last week, we've heard Republican congressmen on the Hill talking about the need for a bipartisan commission. And what they're saying is why they want the commission is they feel that a commission takes the politics out of it, and it will help reduce the sort of the finger pointing among politicians and also give the public some confidence that this is not a political investigation, but rather a more serious investigation to get to the truth.
And of course, we're going to hear more on this next week with a series of congressional hearings that will include the former head of the U.S. Capitol Police. You are reporting on that tonight. Tell us what you know.
Very interesting. We're going to have the former head of the Capitol Police, the former Senate Sergeant at Arms, and the former House Sergeant of Arms all testify. And this is the first time we have heard from these. Well, we've heard from them in the media, but we have not heard from them before Congress. We have not heard a detailed account from these three individuals since the Capitol riot last month. This is the first time we will hear them from them, and it'll be part of the first major hearing into what happened at the Capitol on January 6th. It's going to be, there's three committees, there's 22 investigations going on right now in Congress, and we've got three committees hosting hearings, and all three of these individuals, they'll join Robert Conti, who is the current head of the Washington, D.C. Police Department, and it'll be interesting to see what they have to say and how they defend some of the decisions that were made that day.
The first major hearing. So how do you see this story unfolding in the coming months? As you know, there's been talk about putting a permanent wall around the Capitol. Democrats and Republicans in Congress say they don't want that. So what is the end result of all of this?
I think the end result of all of this isn't known yet. I think we'll know after we have these hearings, after we start to see more details about the commission and what they're looking for, after we start seeing the results of the 22 investigations that are going on into various aspects of this. And you know, we've got also independent. The Justice Department's running their own investigation. We've got the Justice Department Inspector General looking into how the federal agencies responded. There's a lot of investigations. And I think when those investigations start taking shape and we start seeing the results and conclusions, we'll have a clearer picture of what happened and where this is headed to avoid this from happening again.
And realizing it is early, but what do you expect some of the leading questions will be?
I expect a lot of questions, especially for the former head of the Capitol Police, is going to focus on the intelligence aspect of this. What were they warned the night before? We've had indications that law enforcement knew that there were groups planning violence that day. What were they told? Did they pass that information along to anybody else? If they weren't told information, why not? If they were told information, why didn't they act stronger on it? I think we're really going to drill down on the intelligence aspect and find out what they knew, when they knew it, and if they did know information that could have either prevented or mitigated this, why that information wasn't acted on.
And do you think this can be a bipartisan, non-political investigation based on the impeachment that we saw last weekend against former President Trump with charges that he incited the events on January 6th?
If you're talking specifically about the hearing next week, I don't expect that to be much of a bipartisan effort, only because, and Steve, you know, because you've been in Washington for a long time, none of these hearings are ever bipartisan. Both sides have their talking points. Both sides have the point that they want to hammer, and their questions will focus on that. I think what we need to do is start waiting for more of the independent investigations to come out to learn more about what happened here. I expect what we'll see is people just trying to score political points next week.
A story that we will be following with your reporting. Jeff Murdock, available at WashingtonTimes.com. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Steve. I appreciate it.
A new statement released late this afternoon, 4 pages in length, by former President Donald Trump, and he takes aim at the Republican Party and the Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell. Let me read part of what former President Trump is saying this evening. Quote, The Republican Party can never again be respected or strong with political, quote, leaders like Senator Mitch McConnell at its helm. McConnell's dedication to business as usual, status quo policies, together with his lack of political insight, wisdom, skill, and personality, has rapidly driven him from the majority to the minority leader. And it will only get worse, says President Trump. The Democrats and Chuck Schumer play McConnell like a fiddle. And they've never had it so good. And they want to keep it that way. We know our America First agenda is a winner, not McConnell's Beltway First agenda or Biden's America Last. The former president says, quote, Mitch, referring to Mitch McConnell, is a dour, sullen, and unsmiling political hack. And if Republican senators are going to stay with him, they will not win again. He will never do what needs to be done or what is right for our country. Where necessary and appropriate, I will back primary rivals who espouse making America great again and our policy of America First. And this final statement from the former president, this is a big moment for our country, and we cannot let it pass by using third-rate leaders to dictate our future. That statement by former President Trump released late this afternoon. In an emergency vote last night, North Carolina's Republican Party voting unanimously to censure Senator Richard Burr just a few days after he cast a guilty vote in former President Trump's second impeachment trial. Now in his third term, Senator Burr will step down at the end of next year, creating an open seat in the U.S. Senate in North Carolina. He, of course, was one of seven Republican senators to vote guilty in Trump's impeachment for inciting an insurrection related to that attack on January 6th. And on CNN this morning, Michael Whatley, who is the chairman of the North Carolina Republican Party, defending his state party's decision.
Well, I think the what we saw coming out of the vote on Saturday across the state of North Carolina, I talked to over hundreds of volunteers, of party leaders, of activists from every part of the state, and they're very disappointed with the vote that we saw from Senator Burr, particularly after he had said that the impeachment process in the Senate was unconstitutional.
What responsibility do you, as the Republican Party chair in North Carolina, think the former president bears for what happened on January 6th?
I think the responsibility lies with those people who broke the law, who attacked the Capitol, who attacked those police officers and caused the violence and mayhem, which is completely reprehensible and unjustifiable.
That from CNN this morning and the chairman of the North Carolina Republican Party after censuring Republican Senator Richard Burr for his vote. Now, in announcing his vote, Senator Burr's office issuing a statement. It reads in part, quote, "The president bears responsibility for these tragic events. The evidence is compelling that President Trump is guilty of inciting an insurrection against a co-equal branch of government and that the charge rises to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors. I do not make this decision lightly, but I believe it is necessary. By what he did and by what he did not do, President Trump violated his oath of office to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States." That in a statement by Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina. Meanwhile, in an interview with Wisconsin radio station WISN-AM, Wisconsin's Republican Senator Ron Johnson said what he witnessed on January 6th did not seem like an armed insurrection. Here's part of that interview.
One thing, and this will get me in trouble, but I don't care. Again, I condemn what happened. I mean, it was reprehensible. Never should have happened. But there were groups of agitators that were the tip of the spear that caused that. Not the tens of thousands of Trump supporters who would never even contemplate that. And quite honestly, where the video was edited, where people were helping police, okay? Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is, this didn't seem as like an armed insurrection to me. I mean, armed, when you think here of armed, don't you think of firearms?
Mm-hmm.
Here's questions I would have liked to ask. How many firearms were confiscated? How many shots were fired? I'm only aware of one, and I'll defend that law enforcement officer for taking that shot. It was a tragedy, okay? But I think there was only one. Mm-hmm. You know, if that was a planned armed insurrection, man, you had really a bunch of idiots.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know,
I would like to know what pockets of planning did occur versus what was just people that came afterward and thought, oh, the Capitol's open. We're protesting in the Capitol now. Because you watched that video, and all sorts of people were just, I mean, there were tens of thousands of people there to protest, yes, but they were just there to enjoy the day and protest peacefully. And once people were streaming up the Capitol steps, once it was opened by the insurrectionists or whatever you want to call them, I think you did have all sorts of people that, oh, the Capitol's open and we're just going to protest in here now. There were all sorts of people who didn't have a malicious intent that then followed into the Capitol and made it look even worse. I'd like to know what was organized versus what wasn't, because, as you say, it was all inexcusable, but there are differences here.
And I'm trying to think, you know, what point did I think this was, whoa, this is way worse than I thought it was, sitting in the Senate chamber thinking a couple of idiots broke in,
yeah,
and, you know, police have to take care of them. I mean, I'm sitting back in my office watching video of the armed insurrectionists staying within the lines inside the Capitol. You know, they're not even venturing outside of the roped areas, right? I'm seeing a bunch of people milling about. It wasn't until I really saw the video in the trial that you really saw what was happening and how officers got injured. You know, here's a question, Officer Sicknick, you know, tragic death.
Yeah.
For a month, we've been told he was killed by a protester hitting him with a fire extinguisher. Now, we saw in the video a fire extinguisher being thrown at law enforcement. But now we know that Officer Sicknick, that's not how he died. We don't know how he died.
Mm-hmm.
This is a month and a half later, and we don't know how he died, but apparently there's an autopsy. He went to a coroner. I mean, I think we have confirmed it wasn't, there's no blunt force trauma against his body. Why didn't the coroner immediately release the true cause of death when you had the story out there that he was bludgeoned to death by a fire extinguisher?
According to Capitol Police, 5 people died. Dozens more were injured on January 6th. Those comments from Wisconsin's Republican Senator Ron Johnson. The interview on WISN AM radio. Illinois Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger tweeting the following quote, "What? Must have been in a different insurrection than I was," unquote. Well, at NewYorkTimes.com, this headline, Adam Kinzinger's lonely mission, censured by his party, shunned by his family members, the 6th-term Illinois congressman is pressing Republicans to leave Donald Trump behind and risking his career to do so. It reads in part, quote, 2 days after Congressman Kinzinger called for removing former President Trump from office following the January 6th riot in the Capitol, 11 members of his family sent him a handwritten 2-page letter saying that he was in cahoots with, quote, the devil's army for making public a break with the president. And in the letter, they said, quote, oh, my, what a disappointment you are to us and to God. You have embarrassed the Kinzinger family name. The author of the letter was Karen Otto. She's the congressman's cousin. The story is accompanied by a 6-minute video from the Illinois lawmaker. Here is a portion.
This is no time for silence. Not after the last month. Not after the past few years. Someone needs to tell the truth. Someone needs to say what history needs to hear. So here I am. The Republican Party has lost its way. If we are to lead again, we need to muster the courage to remember who we are. We need to remember what we believe and why we believe it. Looking in the mirror can be hard, but the time has come to choose what kind of party we will be and what kind of future we'll fight to bring about. The choice is ours, and I've made mine. My name is Adam Kinzinger. I proudly serve the people of Illinois in Congress. I've served America in the Air Force, and I still serve as a lieutenant colonel in the Air National Guard. And I choose to renew the Republican Party. The GOP inspired me as a young boy to love and serve our country. And I'm not alone. Tens of millions of our fellow citizens have flocked to the Republican banner. They've been inspired by its unapologetic stand for freedom and the flag. But today's Republican Party, it's not the one I joined. The GOP I signed up for was built on a foundation of principle, and it was filled with hope. We believed a brighter future was just around the bend, and we fought tirelessly to get there. We stood for equal opportunity, firm in our conviction that a poor kid from the south side of Chicago deserves the same shot as a privileged kid from Highland Park. We knew that if we brought everyone into America's promise, we would unleash a new era of American progress and prosperity. But in recent years, we've forgotten our principles. The party that always spoke of a brighter tomorrow, it no longer does. It talks about a darker future instead. Hope has given way to fear, outrage has replaced opportunity, and worst of all, our deep convictions are ignored. They've been replaced by poisonous conspiracies and lies.
That from Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger, the full six-minute video, part of a lengthy story on his politics. It can be found on the New York Times homepage. Well, early Saturday evening, we learned that White House Deputy Press Secretary, now former Press Secretary T.J. Ducklow, had resigned his position after admitting to what he said were abhorrent, disrespectful, and unacceptable threats he made to a female reporter in January. It came a day after he was placed on a one-week suspension following the incident. Ducklow had reportedly threatened to, quote, destroy political reporter Tara Palmieri after she continued to pursue a story about his relationship with Axios.com reporter Alexi McCammon, a conversation that at times turned vulgar. Today, NBC News White House correspondent Peter Alexander with this question to the White House press secretary.
Last question of a candidate's housekeeping around here. T.J. Ducklow, as we know, is no longer working for this White House. He was suspended for a week after comments that he made to a female journalist. The president, as you know, on Inauguration Day said, if you're ever working with me and I hear you treat another with disrespect, talk down to someone, I promise you I will fire you on the spot. No ifs, ands, or buts. He didn't fire T.J. on the spot. He has since resigned. Has the president's position on talking down or disrespecting others changed?
I think the president leads by example, and I try to do the same. And on Saturday, when we announced that T.J. Ducklow had resigned his position, something we all agreed was the right path forward, I made clear that every day we're going to try to meet the standard set out by the president in treating others with dignity and respect, with civility, and with a value for others through our words and our actions. He's no longer employed here, and I think that speaks for itself.
That from White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow gained 64 points, the S&P was off by 2, and the Nasdaq losing 48. Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates out with a new book titled How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, The Solutions We Have, and the Breakthroughs We Need. In it, he explains how we reached this point from his perspective and his concerns about what we could do to potentially avert the coming disaster that he says we're facing in the decades ahead. Bill Gates making the rounds with network interviews, including this with Anderson Cooper for 60 Minutes.
You've said that governments need to do the hard stuff, but not just go after the low-hanging fruit. What's low-hanging fruit?
Passenger cars, part of the electric generation with renewables, the things everybody knows about, that's getting almost all the money, not the hard parts, which is the industrial piece, including the steel and cement. Those pieces we've hardly started to work on.
No one thinks much about cement and steel, but making it accounts for 16% of all carbon dioxide emissions, and the demand is only growing. The world will add an estimated 2.5 trillion square feet of buildings by 2060. That's the equivalent to putting up another New York City every month for the next 40 years. So one innovative company Gates has been pouring money into is CarbonCure. They inject captured carbon dioxide into concrete.
What they do is they stick CO2 in here and the cement, and they mix them up. And so you're able to actually get rid of some CO2 by sticking it in the cement. Uh-huh. Right now, they get rid of about 5%, but they have a next generation they can get to 30%.
The carbon has been just injected into this, so it's captured it, so it's not going to be released into the atmosphere.
That's right.
Anderson Cooper with Bill Gates and the Microsoft co-founder out with a new book, How to Avoid a Climate Disaster. That interview available at cbsnews.com. A reminder, all of C-SPAN's coverage, it's easy to get, available online anytime at cspan.org. Be sure to subscribe to this program. It's also a podcast, so you never miss an episode. I'm Steve Scully for the Tuesday edition of Washington Today, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.
C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Every day, we take your calls live on the air on the news of the day, and we discuss policy issues that impact you. Coming up Wednesday morning, we talk about the possible returns of earmarks with taxpayers for Common Sense President Stephen Ellis and Congressional Institute President Mark Strand. Then author Clyde Prestowitz on his book about U.S.-China trade and economic relations. Watch C-SPAN's Washington Journal, live at 7 Eastern, Wednesday morning. And be sure to join the discussion with your phone calls, Facebook comments, text messages, and tweets.